Second thing, the second guy also turned around to close the inner door quietly and precisely. I let him get it done. Then he raised his eyes and saw me. The first guy saw me. Third thing, I shot them both. 2 3-round bursts, brief, muted, purring explosions, each a quarter of a second long. I aimed for the base of their throats and let the muzzle climb, stitch upward toward their chins. They were small men. Their necks were narrow, and mostly full of arteries and spinal cords. Ideal targets. The noise of the gun was much louder in the roofed alley than it had been out in the open. Loud enough for me to worry about it. But the inner door was closed, and it was a stout piece of wood. Once upon a time it had been an outer door, before some earlier owner had sold his air rights. The two guys went down, my spent shell cases rattled away across the concrete. I waited. No immediate reaction. 8 rounds gone, 22 remaining. 7 men captured, 3 more down, 3 still walking and talking. Plus the Hoths themselves. I searched the new dead guys. No ID, no weapons, no keys, which meant the inner door wasn't locked. I left the 2 new bodies next to the first one, in the shadow of the trash can. Then I waited. I didn't expect anyone else to come through the door. Presumably, the old Brits on the northwest frontier had eventually gotten wise about sending out rescue parties. Presumably, the Red Army had. Presumably, the Hoths knew their history. They ought to have. Svetlana had written some of it. I waited. The phone vibrated in my pocket. I pulled it out and checked the window on the front. Restricted call. Lila. I ignored her. I was all done talking. I put the phone back in my pocket. It stopped vibrating. I put my gloved fingers on the inner door's handle. I eased it down. I felt a latch let go. I was fairly relaxed. 3 men had gone out. Conceivable that any one of them might return. Or all 3 of them. If anyone was inside, watching and waiting, there would be a fatal split second of delay for recognition and a decision. Friend? A foe? Like a major league batter sorting a fastball from a curveball, a fifth of a second, maybe more. But no delay for me. Anyone I saw was my enemy. Anyone at all. I opened the door. No one there. I was looking at an empty room, the abandoned restaurant's kitchen. It was dark and dismantled. There were shelves of old cabinets and gaps in the countertops where appliances had been hauled away to the second-hand stores on the Bowery. There were old pipes in the walls where once faucets had been attached. There were hooks in the ceiling where once saucepans had hung. There was a large stone table in the center of the room, cool, smooth, slightly dished from years of wear. Maybe once pastry had been rolled on it. More recently, Peter Molina had been murdered on it. There was no doubt in my mind that it was the table I had seen in the DVD. No doubt at all. I could see where the camera must have been positioned. I could see where the lights had been set. I could see knots of frayed rope on the table legs, where Peter's wrists and ankles had been tied. The phone vibrated in my pocket. I ignored it. I moved on. There were 2 swinging doors leading to the dining room. 1 in, 1 out. Standard restaurant practice. No collisions. The doors had porthole windows set eye-high to an average man of 50 years ago. I ducked down and peered through. An empty room, large and rectangular. Nothing in it except a lone orphan chair. Dust and rat shit on the floor. Yellow light coming in from the street through the big, filthy window. I pushed the outdoor with my foot. Its hinges yelped a little, but it opened. I stepped into the dining room, turned left and left again, found a back hallway with restrooms, two doors labeled Ladies and Gentlemen. Brass signs, proper words. No pictograms, no stick figures in skirts or pants. Plus two more doors, one in each of the side walls. Brass signs. Private. One would lead back to the kitchen, the other would lead to the stairwell and the upper floors. The phone vibrated in my pocket. I ignored it. Standard tactical doctrine for any assault. Attack from the high ground. Couldn't do it. Not an available option. Around the time the Israeli list was being written, the SAS in Britain had been developing a tactic of rappelling off roofs into upper-story windows, or smashing through the roof tile itself, or blowing through directly from one adjacent attic to another. Fast, dramatic, and usually very successful. Nice work if you could get it. I couldn't. I was stuck with the pedestrian approach. For the time being, at least. I opened the stairwell door. It swept an arc through a tiny 30-inch by 30-inch ground floor hallway. Directly across from me, close enough to touch, was the door that led out to the residential entrance, to the street door with the single bell push and the crime scene tape. Directly out of the tiny hallway rose a single, narrow staircase. It turned back on itself halfway up and rose the rest of the way to the second floor, out of sight. The phone vibrated in my pocket. I pulled it out and checked it. Restricted call. I put it back in my pocket. It stopped vibrating. I started up the stairs. Chapter 79. The safest way up the first half of a dog-leg staircase is to walk backward, looking upward, with your feet spread wide. Backward and looking upward, because if overhead resistance comes your way, you need to be facing it. Feet spread wide, because if stairs are going to creak, they're going to creak most in the middle, and least at the edges. I shuffled up like that to the halfway break, and then sidled sideways, and went up the second half going forward. I came out in a second-floor hallway that was twice the size of the first-floor version, but still tiny, 30 inches by 60, one room to the left, one to the right, and two dead ahead, doors all closed.